Please, Ken Stubbs joins the call.
Hello, Ken.
Hello there.
Hi, Ken.
Hello,
Chuck. We're just starting the recording, so bear with us here.
You see, Jack and I are joining too. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're not recording.
We should start this meeting by trying to record attendance. Glenn or Chuck, can I ask you to sort of read through the names and then have anyone add as opposed to doing it here and not here? There will be no votes at this meeting, so we don't need that risk, but please.
So you'd like me to read the names,
please? Just
read
the names so that we have a listing of the predominant attendees.
Thank you. Avery Doria, Cheryl Langdonor, Danny Younger, Chuck Gomes, Olaf Nordling, Jeff Newman, Ron Andrus, Jordi Iparagvira, Michael Connor, Kurt Pritz, Dan Halloran, Tony Holmes, Craig Schwartz, Patrick Jones, Christina Rosette, J. Scott Evans, Edmund Chun, Dirk Krishkinovsky, Anthony Harris, Mike Pelage, Heike Jensen, Caroline Greer, Greg Ruth, Paul Diaz, William Drake, Marika Koenig, Sebastian Bachelet, Mary Wong, Mike Rodenbach, Liz Gasper, Nick Woods, Stefan van Gelder, Pierre Bonis, Ken Stubbs, Ute Dekker, Vander Scarzizini, and Olga Cavelli.
Thank you. Quite a crowd.
And Carlos Aguirre has just joined us.
Okay, thank you. As I say, I apologize for my voice. I'm going to go through the agenda quickly. I'm going to go through the guidelines for the meeting. In terms of the agenda, we have various topics. We have basically the main issue is to discuss areas at variance with the GNSO policy principles, recommendations, and guidelines. There's been a certain amount of conversation about there being areas that were in conflict. There's also been a certain amount of feedback from the staff saying, well, hold on there, not really, or you don't understand, or there's a good reason why we had to. But we've never really managed to have that conversation, to have the staff basically look at those with us and basically talk about why it is as it is. We certainly had time to ask lots of questions about how does this work, how does that work, and that's not what this meeting is about. Excuse me? Oh, okay. So that's not specifically the purpose of this meeting. It's to basically look at those issues that may or may not be, but appear at this point to some people to be in variance with principles, recommendations, and guidelines. The second shorter item and lesser item is the GNSO passed two motions that relate to GTLDs at the last meeting, and I wanted to give the staff a chance to get clarification from us on those motions, and not necessarily to discuss whether the motions were a good idea or a bad idea, but just to make sure that we come out of this with both sides sort of understanding, you know, what we're all doing, so that we're that. I've asked the staff, and I don't know if they're ready yet, and I'll hopefully stop talking soon, to give an overview on the comments received. Again, this is not the meeting where we're going to discuss the comments in detail. Is this a good comment? Is this a valid comment? Etc. But basically to get an overview. Not everybody has had a chance or even necessarily will have a chance to read all 100 pages other than the staff. And so I'm asking them to give us a good report on that, but I'm not sure that's ready. And then finally, to discuss the follow-up to this meeting. And that contains anything from, great, everything's covered, we can leave it alone, to, do we need to write up something on these variances? Does the council need to form a drafting team to, you know, work out any of these issues? And if so, is that something that needs to be done immediately? Or is that something where enough has been said now that we're really paying attention for next time? So those are all questions. I don't know. Does anyone have anything to add or say about the agenda at this point? Okay. Going on to the guidelines for the meeting. First of all, we've got a very large crowd. We've got council members. We've got alternates for council members. We have staff, and we have many, many advisors. I mean, observers, advisors, observers. Now, in inviting the observers, we weren't exactly clear whether observers could speak or not speak. And what I'm asking is, given the number of people, please hold off. But if you absolutely have to, do ask to be in the queue. But please let the council and the council alternates have a priority if you can. I'm asking that we keep to the topic under discussion and that we not stray off into the many, many side topics there are that are really quite interesting and exciting also. I'm asking people to not repeat questions and issues someone else made, and that is to indicate that it's important I want to say it too. I'm asking to please just, if the issue's been raised, if the question has been answered, or whatever, please leave it for now. It's not a time to bring up new objections to the implementation plan. We had lots of time to send comments, but only to understand issues as they relate to the principles, recommendations, and implementation guidelines. Also, I'd like to avoid discussing whether the recommendation was a good one or a bad one. We certainly had lots of time to do that. We still all have our varying opinions on whether recommendation, 27 was good or bad, but, they are what they are, and they've been approved, etc. And finally, we'll see what we get to by the end of 2 hours and figure out what to do next. So, any questions on the guidelines? Okay, and we'll run as we do normally, then I'll bring up an issue, and then I'll take a cue, and then we'll go through the cue. And, of course, if there's side issues and what someone else said, we may allow a sub-cue, as it were, on that side issue. But I'd also like to minimize that so that we don't start rat-holing. We don't have a lot of time. Okay, to start first, and these are the areas of variance, are ones that I've basically heard people talking about. And I wrote down and I put in front of the council and on the wiki, almost a week ago now, and no one's come to me saying, "Oops, take that one out, that one didn't fit," or, "I think I got one mention of something I needed to add." So the first one on the list, and starting from the top, was Principle G. And basically, do the review criteria infringe on freedom of expression? And that was, so I open up the queue. Does anybody want to speak to that issue? Perhaps it's actually best to have the staff sort of explain why it does or doesn't to start and then start the queue from there. Is that a workable way? Is that okay with you, Kurt?
Well, yeah, I want to. I just have a couple of comments and introduction, and then.
Okay, please. And apologize for not giving you the chance for that. So please go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, I just want to say that as you know, as you could guess, staff and across the breadth of the ICANN staff is currently in the process of preparing analysis of the public comments and determining how the guidebook can be changed to accommodate the comments that have been made through the public comments. So that is a very intense effort that's going on right now. If you think about a lot of the public comment causing a reanalysis and some causing an examination of basic principles that went into the analysis, it's just not a adjustments to the guidebook, but rather it is redoing some analysis in order taking into account a different point of view that might not have been in place when the original analysis was made. So.
But that analysis, right, is sort of the analysis of what the principles, recommendations mean. It's not actually changing those.
No, of course
okay.
not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm prefacing this discussion with saying staff right now is very focused on that, and taking into account every comment and trying to communicate to the community, and perhaps you can help us with this, that in fact we're looking at each and every comment, everyone's been listened to, and there's quite a bit going on. So in the writing you'll see coming out of this, you won't just see conclusions, but you're going to see an attempt, which is very hard in the ICANN community, to convey that, you know, every individual comment's been listened to. And so, where are we? We're at a point where, you know, we published the draft and we're iterating the guidebook in according to some of the comments that were received, and another draft version will be issued.
Okay.
So how did we get here? You know, I think everybody on the call knows that there's considerable overlap in the policy and implementation processes. While the policy development was going on, the council requested from staff information on the implementability of certain policy recommendations. While the board was considering the policy recommendations, both the council and the staff worked together to demonstrate the implementability of the recommendations. And then, since the board has approved the recommendations, you know, the staff has provided several briefings and taken several comments from the council and the open community on how the initial guidebook might be configured, and now is taking comments on how we could make an adjustment to the guidebook. So, you know, and as part of that, we've provided a couple documents indicating how, you know, the policy recommendations map to specific implementation aspects. So I was looking at some of that old documentation last night where we first talked about, well, we've got this these policy recommendations, guidelines, and principles, and how are we going to map that into implementation plans. So here we are, we're at where we have this first draft for public comment, and I'd like to, with the topics, you know, for this meeting, give a really broad hint at a specific question, but you know, really don't indicate the specific issue. So Aubrey, are we launched? Did you start with the first question about Principle G?
Yep.
That was a yes, Kurt.
Yep. I can speak, Aubrey. So.
That's quite right. First of all, I just wanted to respond that I think we all appreciate the amount of work and feedback, and I'm certainly grateful that you all were able to make yourself available for this meeting. So yeah, at the moment we're at, if we're ready, is to start with Principle G. I don't know if any of the people on this call want to add more detail to that. I was trying to basically put in neutral statements or questions about the statements that I had heard from people, as opposed to trying to get into detail. So, you know, sort of give you a chance to make an opening, you know, statement about, you know, how you feel the review criteria compare and deal with the issue of freedom of expression, and then allow the other people on the call to comment and go back and forth on it.
Okay. The review criteria is really broad, so I'll talk about a couple specific instances. So, for example, in the development of standards for objections and dispute resolution processes, we worked with outside providers, and including those who will provide the dispute resolution services, in order to develop standards. And in each case, you know, the information provided to them was essentially cut and pasted out of the GNSO report and documentation, and specifically started with, you know, freedom of expression, and that the process seeks not to curtail that, and then talked about how some governments, you know, seek to limit you know, everything about freedom of expression is a limit on it. And ICANN in its public documents does not use the term, you know, freedom of expression, because we're limiting it because we're not a government. But, you know, what limits should be put on the process? But so the answer is that, you know, the Roman numeral one in formulating the standards was, you know, it shouldn't curtail freedom of expression rights. Roman numeral number two, in the example of morality and public order, say, were the treaties that the GNSO called out that should be considered in formulating the standards. And then Roman numeral three was then the policy recommendation. And in fact, in the case of morality and public order, you'll see the exact wording of the policy recommendation, you know, in that standard that calls out only those items should be excluded that are recognized or enforceable under generally accepted international principles of law. So all the development was targeted at that, and a lot of the writing was about principles of free speech, you know, as a preamble to doing any work on it. So I think, you know, and I don't know if there's any other of the criteria that attendees on the call want to discuss.
Okay, thanks. I'll take a cue. If anyone does have an issue that they would like to put before Kurt on the Principle G and the review criteria, do I have anyone? I don't. I'll thank Kurt for the answer.
Well, Aubrey, let me ask a question of the people on the call that I would only request a very brief answer to. But is there anyone on the call that thinks that the implementation guidelines limit freedom of expression, understanding that the GNSO, what they tried to implement was the GNSO recommendations, where obviously we did have recommendation six, where some people obviously opposed, but put that aside, in terms of what they've done, does anyone on the call think that freedom of expression was limited beyond what was in the GNSO recommendations? And just a yes answer by anybody and identify yourself would be fine.
Is there anyone that would like to comment?
Hi, this is Mary Wong from NCUC. Can I just make a brief comment?
Of course, please.
Yeah, hi. Chuck, I'm not sure I can give a yes or no answer. It's simply that, as everybody knows, NCUC has a big concern with freedom of expression and with Principle G as reflected in the current guidelines. So I think for now, we just want to say that we appreciate that the staff are looking at the issue, and that in our statement and our comments, we had asked for more information as to the research done and the experts consulted. We hope that information will be provided before the next round.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Were there any other comments on Principle G or the discussion so far? So, in which case, move on to recommendation one, which was basically dealing with price levels not being discriminatory. And there's certainly been a lot of discussion about price levels, and I don't know whether we should actually be very careful to split this off from guideline B, IGB, which was recommend cost-based fees to different applicants paying different fees, and whether those two can be discussed separately. So perhaps, you know, those two will get combined, but basically, I'll stop for now. Kurt?
I have a question.
Okay, yes.
Tony Harris?
Yes, Tony.
When we're talking about price levels, are we talking about application prices or registry prices to consumers?
Recommendation one was application price.
I'm sorry?
I think recommendation one was the application price.
Okay.
Kurt, Mark can correct it if I was wrong. Kurt?
I was going to talk a little bit about each of them. So the application processing effort is, and the fee associated with that is listed out at expected cost. So there is another recommendation, of course, or another guideline that says that the process should be that ICANN should recover the cost for processing the application. So what ICANN's doing what ICANN's doing in this iteration is working with consultants that might provide evaluation services to further hone those estimates and see if there's any significant changes from what our cost estimates were before. When I read this question, to a certain extent, all pricing is discriminatory because some people, choose not to, not to pay a price. Some people do. So the effort here is to be fair and follow the spirit of the and the letter of the guideline by costing out the process, doing that as well and as often as possible, and doing that. I'm sure there will be iterations between rounds where then costs can be further pointed up. There was more comment on the annual registry fee than on the application fee. So ICANN is certainly doing a lot of work there. We've gotten some of the more constructive comments went to proposing different models for how registry fees might be configured to better facilitate business models. And ICANN is, the big idea here is to create this big fertilized field so new businesses can grow. So we've taken the comments on registry fees very seriously and we fashioned different candidate fee structures that might accommodate that comment, but look at a change. So that's the whole answer, I think.
Okay, thank you. So you did basically cover a little bit of recommendation one and implementation guideline B, so I think I'll open the queue to people on basically both of those topics. Anyone in the queue?
Please add Chuck Aubrey.
Chuck, anyone
and
else?
And Alan.
And Alan, anyone else?
Tony Harris.
Yes, anyone else? Hey, go ahead, Chuck.
Kurt, it seems like under the current model, and I appreciate the fact that the dispute process fees were separated from the other, because that was one way of spreading costs to applicants that where they actually occur. But it seems to me that the current costing model would cause some applicants who really went through relatively cleanly to subsidize others with the fees, and I know that it would be a total nightmare and unfeasible to have each applicant pay the exact costs that they actually incurred to process their application. But I guess in reading all of the public comments on costing and so forth, I wonder if there would be some value in differentiating costs a little bit further than what was done, so that there's less subsidization by some applicants where the cost to process their application turns out to be quite a bit less than what is designed into the system now. And again, I am not talking about an exact cost structure for every different applicant. That would be ridiculous. But some modification, I think, might be helpful to differentiate a little bit between those who incur less costs in the process, the main process, and those who on the other hand, require more time and expense.
Yeah.
Can I understand, Chuck? Did you indicate in which ways it was in variance with the principles and recommendations?
Aubrey, I don't think we were that specific. So I'm not suggesting that what staff did was in contradiction to what the GNSO recommended. We basically just said, it should cover costs. And we didn't really, I don't believe, get into whether some applicants should subsidize other applicants or not, and whether how those costs should be spread out. Obviously, at the one extreme, you have everybody pays the exact same fee for the total thing, and then even that's different than what staff recommended, even with regard to disputes. That obviously would involve even more subsidization by some applicants of where there were no disputes of others. Now, staff has covered that. I'm suggesting that they could possibly consider a little bit more delineation of costs so that it works out even a little bit better than what they have done without going to the extreme of making it exact for every applicant.
If it's okay with you, Kurt, I'll let everyone talk, and then you can address all of them, or would you like to what would you like to address individually?
Well, I think this is a very specific question,
okay,
so
ahead.
Before my poor few memory cells die.
Yeah, right.
Chuck's unwritten policy recommendation is that nightmare and unfeasible implementation should be avoided, so staff agrees with that.
Okay.
I think that's the, that was a joke. So I think that the really short answer is that that's the sort of balancing that went on, but perhaps it should be reexamined. So, for example, the broader principle is where we would try to parse the cost among applicants, where that would give rise, in some cases, that actually gives rise to more uncertainty because. It's just not, it triggers a charge this applicant, but, how much do you charge this applicant? It's really uncertain. And so, in certain cases, parsing the cost further causes more uncertainty, and uncertainty would cause, perhaps an increase in the fee. Or if the parsing, created the need for additional administration, that would raise the cost of the evaluations, the administration evaluation, then that would be an area where we're trying to keep the cost and the effort fairly simple and straightforward. Certainly, we're going to learn stuff in the first round. So one example of that's been controversial and where we've heard the opposite sort of comment that the effort should be subsumed into the general application fee is whether a proposed registry service would possibly disturb the stability of the DNS. And in that case, we think that's going to be a rare occurrence. And when it occurs, though, the price is very well known, the cost is very well known, and it's substantial. So... even if it's very rare, it might occur one time, it might occur 10 times or 20 times. And so because it's an individual high cost, that might, materially impact the fees that everyone would have to pay. So in that case, we said that's a perfect candidate for separating out. In other cases where, there could be a blurring between, say, initial and final, initial and an extended business evaluation, and how that occurs and, the debate over, whether you fail and then go into extended evaluation where really we want to, where we really want a smooth running process and not be debating about whether you go into extended evaluation or not. We chose not to. So that sort of balancing, a lot of hours and a lot of talking about it, but I'm not reticent to talk about it again in a different form.
Aubrey, could I follow up with something there briefly?
Please.
Yeah, Kurt, you went into the area kind of my thinking along the same line, because what I was thinking, and it sounds like you guys have already thought that through, which is really not a surprise to me, but... not everyone will go through extended evaluation, so that and you kind of mentioned that. So that was one other differentiation point between the application process. And similarly, not everybody will go through string contention. So those were just a couple thoughts that I had. And again, I have not done the detailed analysis that you guys have, but I think those are areas where maybe the cost could be broken out a little bit differently. And again, I'll defer to you guys doing the detailed analysis because I certainly wouldn't want this to cause costs to go up. Thanks.
Hey, Aubrey, this is Jeff Newman. I know I'm an alternate or observer. If I could jump in a queue on this.
On this topic? Sure, go ahead.
Well, no, I want to jump in. I want to wait.
Oh, you want to just be on the queue?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, please. Okay, Alan.
Much of what I was going to say was covered by Chuck already. I was going to give us one particular example that there's been a fair amount of discussion about the components in the fees that are essentially liability ones that are there in case something blows up, and suggesting that perhaps the different classes of applicants, be they profit, not-for-profit, the equivalent of sponsored, perhaps could be assessed differently and lower those costs in the cases where they're not likely to be to cause major problems in the past. But essentially, I was saying the same as Chuck, that clearly there's going to be some uncertainty in this first go-around because we really don't know which ones are going to cause problems and how they're going to flow. But more discreet classes of applicants might yield very significant differences in fees, and I think that's something that we would like to see in the next draft. Or at least that analysis has been done and confirmed that it's been done.
Okay, thank you. Tony?
Hello?
Hello, Tony.
Okay. Well, actually, Chuck covered quite a bit of what I wanted to say, but there is one thing which I don't think Chuck mentioned, and which is in the comments that we submitted to the book. And that is, we have suggested eliminating the requirement for applicants to pay dispute resolution service providers when responding to an objection. I mean, if the objector pays the DRSP, that's fair enough. That'll make sure we don't have people just object for the heck of it. But really, I mean, all the money that's being asked of an applicant, and on top of that, to have to pay to respond to every objection, it doesn't seem quite right to me.
Is there one of the recommendations or implementation guidelines that this will come to? I'm trying to keep everything on that level, so if there is one that you can point out, that would be good.
Well, it is spelled out in the guidebook that that an applicant has to pay to respond to an objection.
Yes, I understand.
That's the reason I brought this point up in my comments.
Thank you.
I think I have it here if you need the actual.
No, I wasn't looking for from the guidebook, but what we were looking for.
It's in DRSPP 3.3.2, response filing.
Yes, yes, I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
Jeff.
Thanks, Aubrey. Question I have is kind of related to the recommendation and implementation guideline of recovering costs for the application. I think it was going in, and if I'm misstating, people could speak on this phone, it was the understanding or belief that recovering costs would be related to recovering costs of evaluating applications and moving forward in the process. I don't think anyone anticipated recovering costs were to mean to recover costs for the past 3 years that ICANN staff has spent on working on new GTLPs. So in my mind, at least, I see a deviance from or a deviation from what the GNSO recommendations are and what ICANN has chosen to implement, which I believe has resulted in a large chunk of the application fee. So when was it decided by ICANN staff that the last 3 years of work had to be recovered in the application fee? And I don't believe that's something that the GNSO has weighed in on.
Can I get in queue again, Tony Harris?
Okay.
Avery Stefan as well. Stefan Van Gelder, please.
Okay, I've got Tony and Stefan. Kirk, did you want to respond to...
When were the policy recommendations approved by the GNSO? September?
Yeah.
September 2007? So it's about a year and a half, right, Jeff? Not 3 years?
I had understood that it was at least two or more years that you were asking, that you had weighed in on your costs. But
yeah, so it was from that date, so it's a year and a half of development costs, and triggered after this policy development support effort and started the implementation.
But before the board approved it?
Right. But the board told us to go ahead with this implementation effort. So, you know, the question is, you know, why did we include the startup cost as part of the application fee? And I think there's a two bullet answer. One is, let me get my thoughts together here. You know, one is, you know, think about a factory starting up a plant or a business, starting up a manufacturing plant. You know, they have to factor the, what do they charge for their product? Well, if they charge at least the cost, they have to factor in the overhead or product development costs in order to make the product break even. And then, second, you know, how did ICANN get the money? So from a cost accounting standpoint, that's sort of the reasoning in typical product development. And then second is, you know, where did that money come from since ICANN fronted it? And it really came from, you know, the ICANN reserve fund where goals to augment the ICANN reserve were put on hold while we spent money on this. And the contributors. So the question is, should the contributors to the ICANN budget, you know, be charged for what we told them would be a contribution to reserve in the budget, but in fact was used for this effort. And so another way of getting at that decision is that the current contributors to the ICANN budget should see that their contributions go into reserve where, you know, we laid that out in the budget that the reserves would increase at a certain rate and we were unable to. So that's kind of a sincere answer for why the 18-month implementation startup was included in the cost.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have a follow-up question to Kurt's comments, if possible, Ken Stubbs.
Oh, okay, Ken.
And Mike Palage as well.
And Chuck.
Okay, Ken, Mike, and Chuck. Go ahead, Ken.
Yes. Kurt, I'm assuming that the time period you're talking about also includes any work that was done on IDN as well. So any of the work that was done on IDN development prior to the time period, to the start date you're talking about, was in effect written off or charged against previous periods, is that correct? So not being you're not attempting to recover those costs as well in this process.
Right. So it's much too early to discuss how the IDN fast track is going to fall out, but certainly in potential fees to be charged there, we've identified the development of that process and earmarked it, you know, to that effort.
Okay, it'll be to that effort. Okay, thank you. I had my point.
Yes, thank you, Avery. Kurt, on your first point about using the analogy of a startup factory cost, to my knowledge, the ICANN did not take that approach either in the 2000 proof of concept or the 2004 STLD round. So, again, I would have to agree with Jeff that ICANN seeking to recover these costs is inconsistent with its prior activities in previous new GTLD rounds. So, again, I just want to reiterate the points Jeff made. Number two, and this I'll keep this brief because I think it reiterates some of the comments just made by Ken Stubbs, but you talk about how money was somehow diverted from the ICANN Reserve Fund. I would assume that you would be using those same equity principles of, if you will, reinvesting in the ICANN Reserve Fund any money that was, if you will, forwarded in advance of the CCTLD IDN fast track process. So I just want to make sure that ICANN is treating similarly situated people similarly. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to remind everybody to stick to the GNSO recommendations and such, but thank you. Chuck?
Yes, thanks, Aubrey. I think there's a couple points. Mike kind of hit on one of them. But first of all, as far as the funds, the source of the funds that were used for the preparation for new GTLDs, it's very easy to conclude came from the GNSO. So it certainly was not diverting funds from one source of funds to another source. So I think that's an important point to recognize, since the GNSO registrant fees cover well over 90% of the ICANN's revenue. Secondly, and this is what Mike hit on, there seems to be an effort to make sure that the GNSO, that no other activities in ICANN subsidize any GNSO activities, and I'm fine with that. But what I'm not fine with is there doesn't seem to be any concern that the GNSO subsidize other activities, as Mike mentioned, the IDN fast track, and much of new GTLDs had to do with IDNs. And the work that was done there benefits both the CCNSO and the GNSO and their respective communities. And so I think there is an inconsistency there that is important to recognize. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, very briefly, a lot has been said that I wanted to say, and I would just draw attention to something which is the foundational principle of ICANN, to promote competition in the domain name marketplace. And it would seem to me that if funds were used to develop consultants that had to do with the new round of TLDs, ICANN was simply complying with their foundational principle. And I find it difficult to understand why that is would be diverting funds in the wrong, in an incorrect manner.
Okay, thank you. Stefan?
Yeah, thanks, Avery. I just want to go back to the variance with the principles and the recommendations. If you look at recommendation one, there's a part in there about fairness, and it's a point that was that I heard raised in the Cairo Public Forum, to which I've not seen any answer. Is it fair to have a process where certain applicants will not be able to apply as easily as others because the application fee level has been set rather high for them? Now, I know we've touched a little bit on that at the beginning of the call, and it's always going to be unfair for some people. It's always going to be too expensive for some people. But I'm not sure that that there is an element of fairness built into the way that the costs have been proposed at the moment. I thought someone was speaking there. I was just wanted to hear Kurt's views on that.
Okay.
So. You know, our views are we took that input into the implementation that recommendation, and also the one that the process should be done on a cost recovery basis, and made the very best calculation we could that we continue to hone to say, you know, what's fair. Well, if we were to arbitrarily lower or raise the price from what we perceive the cost to be, then we would be including or excluding others on a somewhat arbitrary basis, where the one sound reason for setting an application fee, I think, and the one objective way is to say let's recover costs. Because this is the first round and there are so many uncertainties, I think that there will be considerable learning from this round, and an ability to be able to parse types of applications or provide a different fee structure or some sort of grant structure for other applicants that might not in a position where they can't afford the evaluation fee. So remember, this is the first draft of the first round, and that so certainly ICANN staff and the council and I think the community share your input that we want to make this process and this opportunity available to as many people we can. I just have a couple more comments on the costing out with regard to not doing it this way in the past. Some I know in the 2003 round when we did when we created the $55,000 fee, we had put in that number some of the development effort, but the $55,000 fee turned out to be inadequate in retrospect. And so what we've learned from the first two rounds is that the process needs to accommodate all these various contingencies that you see in the different panels and string confusion and the objection-based process and comparative evaluation. And all these developments are really significant departures from how the first two rounds were conducted. And so, you know, those first two rounds were a big part of this. There's considerable learning that went into there, and that's why I think there'll be learning going forward in the future. And I just want to reiterate something about IDN. So there's some IDN development costs in this application fee, and because there will be IDNs in the GTLDs, and but IDN development costs for a fast track are parsed out, and with the goal of, you know, assigning costs to where they belong most accurately. But I understand Chuck's comment in that regard.
Hey, Avery, may I just follow up?
Quite quickly, but I think most of it has been said, so I'd like to move on, but okay.
Avery, this is Jeff. I have one thing that's been said and really brief, too.
I just want to make a really brief suggestion, Stefan, again.
Okay.
I understand what you say, Kurt, and I also understand that we're at the beginning of a process and we're not certain about the way it's going to go. I just have one suggestion about maintaining fairness might be to try and differentiate between certain types of applicants. Even broad types of applicants might help certain categories come into the process more easily. And the fact that there's absolutely no differentiation between any type of applicant does mean that some get harsher treatment than others at this stage.
Okay, thank you.
This is just on, you know, Kurt, you made the analogy to a for-profit factory and recovering historical costs. I think
I didn't say a for-profit factory. I said in calculating what the break-even point is.
Okay. My point's still the same, is that had the GNSO known that the interpretation, known how you were interpreting the GNSO recommendation, I think the GNSO may have insisted on some sort of oversight over the cost that you were spending to make sure that its principle of fairness, as people have been talking about, could be, and promotion of competition could be implemented. So if in the future the GNSO ever makes a recommendation on recovering costs, I believe that the GNSO should also maintain some sort of role and oversight over what those costs are.
Yes, thank you. As I said, we'll talk later whether we need to do anything further on this, but I think that people have basically gotten the viewpoints on the issue settled. I'd like to move on to recommendation 2 and the extent of confusing similarities.
I've heard several conversations that have never been completed on the application process not necessarily going as far as recommendation 2 intended. So, Kurt.
If there's no further honing of that question, recommendation 2 is implemented by taking into account all types of situations or similarity that might result in user confusion. And the process as first developed is an objection-based process, along with the other reasons for objecting to a string. And the standard for that process says that user confusion would result, and so that confusion could be visual, it could be oral, it could be meaning. The standard is that the likelihood that there would be user confusion. So the first iterations of the implementation here put that in. At a later date, we in our thinking, we also decided to put in an early examination into the process to catch, you know, obvious cases of visual similarity, where we thought that a panel acting alone without input from somebody who is claiming a type of similarity could look for visual cues and determine if similarity existed in order to cull out applications that are that would result in string confusion with existing TLDs or existing names. So that if you think about how a determination of whether user confusion exists, that the input from the council and our implementation indicated that should be an objection and dispute resolution process, which is what we set up. And then I think that's probably the right approach, especially with cases that are less obvious, such as oral or meaning cases. In that case, you want to hear from someone why they think that's going to result in user confusion. But then we put in the additional protection in the beginning of putting an algorithm into place and determining what the visual confusion are, and then having a panel look at that to see if that confusion existed, to prevent prevent the necessity from objections that might have to occur.
Okay, thank you. I'll take a queue. Anyone want to be in that queue?
No.
Excuse me?
Mike?
And Chuck.
And possibly Christina.
And possibly Christina, okay. Go ahead, Mike.
So Kurt, thanks for the brief introduction there, but I think it doesn't really take into consideration the actual text of the draft applicant guidebook. I think that what has happened is staff has really used a different definition of confusing similarity in the context of string contention than in the context of objections based on trademark or otherwise. So, and I don't understand why that disparity happened. So I guess the question is, why did staff, I believe, unilaterally narrow the definition in the context of string contention to eliminate similarity in meaning, in fact, and in sound, and only go with visual similarity?
So we will relook at the wording in the guidebook, but the intention was that in the objection-based process, that all kinds of similarity be examined. And in fact, it might be subtle, but when you look at the standard for similarity, in the objection process, the word visual is deleted, and so. The standard given to those people is, user confusion exists based on any similarity.
Okay, so the intention was to have the definition consistent throughout. It just hasn't happened that way yet.
I'm sorry, what?
So the intention was to have the definition consistent throughout the document, but it just hasn't happened yet.
So, let me answer it a different way. Well, to reiterate what I said before, it was determined, by input that there should be dispute resolution processes by the, in the GNSO policy recommendations and the user confusion policy recommendation. It was determined that we make this objection-based process for determining if there was string confusion, if there's likelihood of user confusion. The standard for that is any type of confusion in order to any type of similarity resulting in confusion. So that is the objection and dispute resolution process accommodates confusion based on any type of similarity, any type. In order to help in order to make the process more smooth running, it was decided that an additional protection would be put in place early on as a very preliminary look at the strings to determine obvious similarities or where user confusion would result. And those would be based on visual confusion. So is an additional protection in place intended to cull out, so make objections and costs unnecessary by identifying for applicants, you know what, this string's going to result in user confusion. I don't think you want to spend more money than you have to on the evaluation, and we don't want to make potential objectors have to spend money on it. So that was an additional step.
Okay, well, that sounds great, but I think that actually the objection process for string contention has been limited to visual similarity when it should not have been. So I think that needs to change. Thanks.
Yeah, so the standard for the dispute resolution provider just says confusion and not visual confusion.
Could I, this is all up here, could I perhaps attend, because I think, Mike, you're asking the question in a slightly different manner, and, well, while it's true that the first check of the something around 15,000 pairwise combinations we will have to check in the initial evaluation on the string similarity, well, it is on visual, that's foreseen as that. And that establishes the initial and preliminary contention sets. Now, when we go through the objection process, if objections are upheld and visual, well, or similarity is noted, and that is the outcome of the process, well, that adds to the existing contention sets, as well as if an applicant disappears, well, that modifies the contention sets that have initially been established as well. So it's not true to say that the contention sets and handling of the contention sets is limited to visual similarity only, but it is the starting point.
It's Alan. Could you put me in the queue?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is Ken Stubbs. Would you please put me in the queue?
Sorry, Seth Lloyd.
Alan.
This is Kurt. I just want to wrap up on Mike's comment that I did get that the guidebook doesn't make this clear, and so we're going to look at the wording of the guidebook to determine to determine how it can be made more clear.
Aubrey, it was Alan and
yeah,
Ken.
Yeah, I got Chuck, Christina, Alan, and Tim, was it? Oh, okay.
Ken Stubbs.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, Chuck.
All right. I'm going to focus in on the initial evaluation. I understand the difference in terms of the definition of confusing similarity with regard to the dispute process, where the broader definition is definitely used. But there's something, as I was reviewing the initial evaluation with regard to string review, one part of that initial evaluation, something was not clear to me, Kurt. It's clear that the algorithm, which is the first step that the panel will use, the string review panel, is strictly visual similarity. I understand that. But the panel goes beyond just the use of the algorithm, and they use a probability standard, which that's not my purpose to talk about that right now. But did I hear you correctly to say that they're only looking for probability at this level, not the dispute process, they're only looking for probability of visual confusion and not a broader definition of confusion?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. You might want to clarify that in that language. I don't think it says that it's the probability of visual confusion there, but that answers my question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Christina, possibly?
Sure. I guess one of the problems that I have with the guidebook's implementation, the draft implementation of Recommendation 2, is that the implementation of it is going to give benefits, or in Kurt's words, additional protections, to existing TLD registries and ICANN and what other entities have managed to get their names on reserved names lists that aren't going to be available to any other participant in this process. I mean, there's absolutely no basis that's been articulated as to, for example, why, quote, an application that fails the string confusion review and is found too similar to an existing string will not pass the initial evaluation and no further reviews will be available. I have yet to see any articulation as to why those particular participants should be given additional protections and not required to go through the objection process like everyone else.
So it's not, you know, if I said additional protection, what I was intending there was that if somebody applies for something that is with the appropriate standards clear to an evaluation panel, that it would result in user confusion. We thought it beneficial to the applicant and the process and to somebody who might be asked to go to the expense of objecting to identify that early on and saying this will result in string confusion. For other types of string confusion, we thought that, when I said additional protection, I didn't mean a special status accorded to GTLD registries or those seeking to protect reserved names. It was to create some some initial review so that we didn't have to force people that would have to object to obviously similar strength to go to that expense.
Well, then why not afford the same protections to, you know, certain categories of trademark owners or certain, you know, clearly recognized unique, you know, peoples or communities? I mean,
so
if you're going to do it there,
so
you really need to do it everywhere.
Right. So what you're suggesting is some entity should be looking at across all strings to look for obviously objectionable strings.
I'm not necessarily advocating for that, but I'm saying whatever ICANN does, it has to be consistent. It cannot give favored preferential treatment, which is the effect of this, to the existing TLD registries and itself over every other entity out there that's going to be in a position to have to be watching this list and objecting.
So I don't quite understand preferential treatment. Preferential treatment of what over what?
As a practical matter, because the effect of this is that it's going to potentially eliminate the number of objections that existing TLD registries or ICANN will have to initiate, because the string review process will cull those out.
Isn't that good?
Only not unless you're going to do it for everyone else.
This is J. Scott Evans. It's great for ICANN and for the registries. It certainly isn't great for everyone else that has to pay.
Okay, thank you, Jay. I'll put you in the queue.
Well, you know, if you're an applicant, then and this doesn't exist. So this was selected because it is a good candidate for this. So, for example, we've developed this algorithm, and now we're going to have it in many different scripts. And if the algorithm is effective, it could, over time, be accepted as an objective measure of visual confusion. And so we see that as a good, you know, we see this process as a good step in trying to grow the process without disturbing the efficacy of the process.
So then, why not open up the process to other candidates? I guess that's my point. Is that, you know, the outside world sees this as ICANN giving itself and the existing registries preferential treatment over every other category of rights owner or potential objector.
Okay, so
how is ICANN giving itself preferential treatment?
Okay. Because it goes to the reserved names, which I presume ICANN's on the reserved name
list, right.
Yeah?
So this is Jeff Newman.
No, this is Aubrey. I think we're sort of getting far afield of the talking about the specific issues of variance with principles, recommendations, and guidelines,
okay,
and getting into comments about
sure.
what is good and what is bad. And I'm not trying to take a position either way.
Okay.
It's just, but thank you. And I think it's been said and heard. And I'd like to move on to Alan.
Yeah, on a different tone, I'll quickly say why I think what they've done is a good thing. If you start looking at other forms of potential confusion, I think there are going to be far too many false positives and things which the algorithm will say sounds like or various other confusingly similar, which in the real world, human beings sitting at a keyboard would never find confusingly similar. And too many false positives, I think, would cause a very significant problem. So I'm moderately happy with what they've implemented.
You're saying it's not at variance, you believe?
I believe it is not at variance.
Okay, thank you. I had Ken next.
Yes, I wanted to support the comments that Mike Rodenbaum made with respect to the visual similarity being overemphasized at this point in time in the process. I think that as you look at the perception of the Internet user, you find that it is not at all unusual for a specific string to be embedded in the mind of the user, and I will use COM as an example. And it doesn't necessarily, it isn't necessarily how it's presented visually, but it's quite common, for instance, in advertising and so forth, for oral descriptions to be made. And I think what you have there is really a classic case of a potential stability problem. And I think it's extremely important as you move into the IDN sector, especially, that you be aware of the fact that to someone in Chinese or who's using a different script, the perception of a specific string is maybe inconsistent with how that string is being visually presented, and I think that's extremely important.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if I didn't have anyone else in the queue unless, Jay Scott, you had something new you want to do, add in terms of the variance and principles, et cetera.
No, I was rude and interrupted before.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any new points to be added to this particular discussion? If not, I'll move on as we're already past the halfway mark. Okay, the next issue, which is a relative of this issue, was reserved name issues, but specifically two points had been brought up in previous conversations. One had to do with geographic identifiers, where the reserved name says there would be none, and yet there was a process put through that basically establishes reserved names. And then second was the two-character IDNs, where the reserved name said there was no need to reserve two-character IDNs, especially because it excluded many reasonable names in certain scripts, and yet those do appear to be there. Kurt? I turn it over to Kurt, unless somebody else wants to make amplifying remarks on what I just said. Notice I'm talking as briefly as I can. Okay, Kurt, would you like to comment on those? Did I lose Kurt?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
So with regard to geographic names, you know, we took the, you know, we understand the policy recommendations and guidelines of the GNSO and also read the the work of the Reserve Names Working Group and the conclusions that group came to. And, you know, as you know, also have, you know, policy advice from the GAC and also the CTNSO. So we sought to find that common ground. And the result is, I think, you know, we are not, even though this is the heading under reserve names, you know, we saw clearly to not create reserve names for country names, and in fact found that very difficult to implement because of all the different languages. So multiply the difficulty in how you express a country name and then multiply it across a number of languages and the nuances of different languages, and it becomes really tough to implement really fast. So the result is, I think that in the GNSO recommendations, one of the reasons for the community-based objection is for
governments, whether they be federal or city or some other area, to be able to object on a on a community basis. And there's been a lot of discussion, I think, on the GNSO list that these are the sorts of protections. You know, this was the area where geographic names were going to be protected. And so in order to keep the spirit of that and match the spirit of the GNSO recommendations and the writing of the GNSO recommendations and take into account GAC advice, an approval from a relevant government is asking the applicant up front to satisfy one of the four elements required to demonstrate that they are a bona fide community application. So, you know, there has to be a nexus between the string and the applicant. There has to be, you know, restricted registration policies, and it has to be a well-established community, and it has to have community support. So, in the case of certain geographic names, the process asks for that expression of community support as part of the application process up front. Besides taking, trying to make some accommodation of the GAC advice that lived within the GNSO, you know, that still was within the GNSO policy recommendations and guidelines. That was the intent of fashioning the process that way. And then, you know, I want to talk a little bit pragmatically about the necessity of addressing risks to the process, because I think all the GNSO work over the years has pointed to, you know, having a, you know, creating the best policy and then the best implementation of that policy so we could launch this very important work that ICANN's, you know, essentially been doing for 10 years. And ICANN, meaning the big ICANN, everybody on this call. And, you know, one of the things we want to do is eliminate risks and certainly avoid, if we can, the criticism of governments that the process doesn't take into account certain aspects. So we think this approach, you know, matches the intent of the wording of the GNSO policy recommendation in saying that, you know, there should be some protections for community-based labels and other advice.
Okay, thanks. Did you also want to address the two-character IDN before I opened up the queue?
And Aubrey, just to clarify, I think it's probably one and two character is the issue.
Okay, yes, thank you.
And then, let me get a clarification on the one and two character issue. Is the question about, for example, Chinese scripts or Japanese scripts?
Exactly. In other words, I think, you know, the comments that we've heard before, let me go slightly further, has been that, well, in Cyrillic, you know, one or two could be confusingly similar with the CCLDs, and therefore we can't have those. But somehow or other, it seems to have extended to one or two character IDNs of any sort being barred. And when that happens in Chinese, for example, or perhaps Korean, and I don't know how many other languages, it doesn't create any confusion, and therefore, and in fact, it excludes a whole lot of what would be optimal, TLD possibilities.
Yeah. So if I can just go ahead, I think that's exactly right. The applicant guidebook took a conservative approach because that very discussion was ongoing and is still ongoing. So it wasn't settled, and so the applicant guidebook just took the conservative approach of the three-letter names or three-character names. I'm sorry. And but there was a specific comment in the public comment that a single character name should be accommodated in different script, and that's being investigated. So
okay.
I think that's an excellent comment.
Okay, thank you. Can I take a cue now on either of these two issues? I think in the second one there's probably not that much to add, as it'll be fixed. But on the first one, are there any comments people would like to speak to that issue? Okay, hearing none,
thank you for the answer. And I will move on to recommendation 17. And this is perhaps just a clear question. In recommendation 17, recommended clear compliance and sanction processes, and just heard questions basically saying, and what are the clear compliance and sanction processes? That's more of a clarification informational question. While while Kurt is preparing an answer, did anybody want to comment further on that one?
Yeah, so the we certainly received a lot of comments about the agreement, and you know, there were compliance so there was quite a bit of analysis how the graduated sanctions program could be included in the contract, or whether writing additional terms would actually enhance our ability to create compliance. So at the time that we released the agreement, we were still discussing implementation difficulties with some of the graduated sanctions, but they're continuing to be discussed, and I hear that comment because this is a very important. Our ability to have a really clear agreement and be able to enforce it is one of the cornerstones.
Okay, thank you. Would anybody like to comment via the queue for that? 17?
Aubrey, add me, Chuck, please.
Okay, Chuck, anyone else? Go ahead, Chuck.
Just a quick question, Kurt. So if I understand you correctly, staff is still looking at the idea of a graduated sanctions approach in the agreement. Is that correct?
That's right. One of the issues is we're looking for agreement that's uniform across all registries, and so that exploring different models and keeping one agreement is tough to find the area of intersection there, but that's what we're working on.
Thank you.
Would anybody else like to comment on 17? Any questions? Okay. Thank you. I think we may have covered implementation guideline B, recommended cost-based fees with different applicants paying different fees. Are these fees really cost-based? Are some applicants subsidizing other applicants? I don't want to open it up to all the discussions we had already, but since it's here in the agenda, does anybody have anything new they need to ask in terms of variance with that guideline?
I have a comment, Aubrey. It's Chuck.
Okay, Chuck.
Earlier we were talking about fairness, and it ties into that. It also goes into the subsidization question. One of the things we need to keep in mind that I think would be real problematic is if applicants who are competing against one another for GTLDs, if one of those competitors had to subsidize the other to their own detriment. And I think that's why the subsidization issue is really a key issue. Now, I fully understand that all applicants are probably going to be, there's going to be some of this mutual subsidization that's going to occur, just because it would be ridiculously complex if that wasn't the case. But, for example, let's look at the community-based TLDs. It's quite possible that there could be an open TLD applicant and a community-based TLD applicant that are in a contention set for a TLD, and we know that the community-based gets an advantage there in the evaluation process under certain conditions. I think it would be inappropriate if the applicant and for the open one was subsidizing the applicant for the open one. Both of them may be very valid. It's not a question of that, but that would, I think, would be inappropriate. And so I think that needs to be looked at in terms of fees, in particular with regard to many of the comments from community members that I think are very valid. with regard to their inability maybe to pay the fees, but I don't think the solution is to subsidize those fees by from other applicants. I think the solution needs to go ahead to IGO, which was one of the specific recommendations for consideration that the council put in there. Thank you.
Any other comments before I ask Kurt to comment? Go ahead, Kurt.
So I'm sorry, am I commenting on the...
If you wish. I mean, otherwise you could say, you know, no comment.
So I didn't hear you, Avery. I'm sorry, I'm commenting on...
Yes, you're commenting on what just Chuck said, unless you wish to say no comment, in which case, I mean, you know, that's okay too.
So I'm not sure. So Chuck, I agreed with the spirit of a lot of what you said, but I'm not sure that I hooked the whole thing together. But there's a balancing in if I heard you say there might be some increased costs associated with evaluating community-based applicants, and there's also an argument that community-based applicants should pay less because of their financial situation, or they're targeting smaller registries. That sort of thing may or may not balance itself out. But certainly, when we're thinking about charge, you know, if there's further differentiation of fees, we should take into account all costs and make sure you know, it's done in a way that doesn't disadvantage one against the other.
Let me try and simplify it, Kurt, and I'll be brief about this. Like I said, there are a lot of comments that are saying, hey, for community-based applicants, especially from developing countries, they might be eliminated if they can't, they may not be able to afford the fees for applying, and the ongoing fees as well. The solution to that, in my opinion, should not be increasing the fees for everybody else in the applicant pool and reducing the fees for the community-based applicants, but rather should be an approach like the GNSO recommended in IGO, which is on our agenda today, because of the fact that it can create a real conflict between competitors.
Yes, I thank you.
Okay. Did that help?
Well, I tend to agree with that. I don't even tend to. I agree with that. So the issue is in trying to make those determinations over the different costs associated with different types of application. You know, what is the level of uncertainty now before we've even launched a round? And what is the, you know, level of administration required? What is the opportunity for gaming a certain classification of GTLD? So that's why, at least so far for the first round, you see it kept fairly straightforward and simple. So, and then certainly, you know, we want to encourage all the applications that produce will produce viable registry models or a chance at a viable registry model. So, you know, we'll be able to parse those costs a little bit better and make sure the allocations are accurate.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on now to the next category, which was implementation guidelines F. Speaking of board resolution processes in when there's several entities going for the same name, basically the IGF, I mean the implementation guideline F, recommended a board resolution process with no specific recommendation for auctions, yet auctions does seem to be the leading contender. Oh, that was a question that had been brought up by various people. I don't know if anyone wants to add more to the question before I ask Kurt to speak to it. Anyone? Okay, Kurt.
Thank you. So the way the process tracks tracks to the implementation guideline, we think is that the guidebook asks parties to work out the contention for themselves first, if that fails, then also take into account the implementation guideline that provides that a community TLD would be a factor in determining who is awarded the top-level domain. So that maps to the comparative evaluation process where community-based TLDs can elect a comparative evaluation, and then absent that comparative evaluation, the parties are, you know, again encouraged to settle the differences between them, and then the guideline, the reading of the guideline is that and absent that, a process would be put in place to enable efficient resolution of the contention. And then the guideline goes on to say that the ICANN board may be used to make a final decision. So there'll certainly be a lot of effort went into matching this and developing a comparative evaluation process to provide that that consideration for community-based applicants. And as recently as yesterday, a number of us sat in a room for hours and tested different scoring mechanisms for community-based applicants based on the comments that we received that the scoring mechanism should be changed in some way. And refinements and changes are being made to the scoring mechanism based on all that public comment. So a lot went into, a lot has gone into creating a process in front of some efficient, resolution. And then the efficient resolution, is not in the applicant guidebook yet, but we have published papers on, potential resolution methods, which include, auction or lottery or a different type of comparative evaluation, or who offers the most advantage, who offers the best contract terms, or or some other means, and offered papers on why auction is a preferred model, but that's certainly not final, but it's certainly proposed, and to me it matches the writing of the guideline.
Okay, thank you. Would anybody like to comment on that? Answer's fine. Okay. In which case, I'll move on to the last one, which is probably a fairly quick answer, and this is not necessarily one of variance, but it's one where the question has been posed several times. In implementation guideline O, it says that ICANN may put in a plan for a fee reduction schedule for GTLD applicants from economies classified as least developed, and so the question has been, since that is something they may be able to do, is there any plans, is there any discussion on that? I don't know if anyone wanted to add anything more to that before Kurt answers.
Avery, Stefan here, can I just ask a question, point of clarification?
Yeah.
Is that implementation guideline O or N? Because on my chart, it's listed as N.
You're right. It's N. My mistake. Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, IGN, not O. Kurt, can you just tell us a little bit about the way the May was treated?
Yeah, I think this is a really important issue, and you know, is you know, it's a guideline here, and it's also you know, wrapped up in ICANN's mission to encourage stakeholder participation in different regions. So it's really important. So I don't want to appear to give it short shrift. I don't know how to you know, augment my explanation earlier regarding how to create different fee structures for different entities without understanding what those entities might be, or potential gaming, or how the costs could be allocated to, you know, then costs would have to be allocated to other applicants. And I think that in the second round, for example, we'll have a very clear picture for ICANN's costs. There'll be an opportunity, perhaps, to reduce fees, and there'll be an opportunity to establish programs for these sorts of applications. But in the initial round, the complexity around that and trying to manage it with all the other uncertainty in the program would just add additional risk.
Okay, thank you. Anyone wish to comment on that further at this point?
Alan, I have a brief comment.
Okay, Alan, anyone else? Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I guess I was rather disappointed, given that there are so many other areas, as you point out, that you are making estimates of what the risks are and putting your stake in the ground, and especially given that you are predicting there will be auctions with significant revenue, that this wasn't one of the ones factored in, and perhaps imperfect, but nevertheless some options presented to allow lower costs from developing countries.
Alan, this is Kurt. So is there somebody or anybody on the call, some entity we could work with, do you think, that might, you know, be an independent provider of grants, so we could you know, do the research to find out if there's maybe not a provider of grants, but you know, somebody to direct parties to different places where they might get grants to do this, and that ICANN would highlight that as part of the application, that at least in the first round, we could provide some aid in saying, you know, if you have this great idea and you want some financial assistance, here's the sorts of entities that help you out.
You're looking at pointing to other people to grant and not reserving some money to do it within ICANN.
No, I think in subsequent rounds, we will definitely do that. I was just thinking this would
what one could certainly talk. To be honest, I don't think there's an awful lot of opportunities there at this point.
Okay, but one would hesitate to put people's names on the record right now, but perhaps people can talk to you offline about people who might be able to do that. You know, but it'd be terrible to put a grant provider's name on the record without having talked to them first.
And I'm not sure there'll be a lot who would be willing to have their name on this particular one at this time.
Right. Okay. Now, just any other comments on limitation guideline N? Okay. Were there any other principles, recommendations, or implementation guidelines where people felt there were variances between what the GNSO put forward and what had been published in the plan? If so, now's a good time to bring them up. There's been a chance for people to send them in earlier, but I don't know if any got missed. Did any get missed? Okay. None put on the list. That's great. Well, I guess we did capture them. Okay. Close off that topic then, unless anybody has any final comments on the issue of principles, recommendations, and guideline variants with the plan. No? Okay, great. Okay, the next item I had, and Chuck, I wasn't planning to do this to you, but I might, if you could basically, we passed two motions in the GNSO at our last meeting. One to do with the timing in terms of IDNT TLDs, the introduction of them into the route, and the other one dealing with guideline, implementation guideline E, where we basically recommended that
4-month period we had put into the implementation guidelines be divided differently because of the need for a further draft. I don't know if you want to go into those motions any further, but I'm about to choke if I keep talking.
You've done a very good job, Avery. My compliments. I hope you don't have repercussions after the call. I'd be happy to talk about the two motions if there's interest in the group and me doing that.
I just want to make sure that the staff who's doing the work on the implementation plan understand, to make sure that there's an understanding of the implications of those. Perhaps there are no questions, then we can just pass it by.
Okay. Let me give a 2-minute overview of the two motions. The first one that was passed and the latter one that Avery referred to changed the implementation recommendation that the council had submitted to the board with regard to the communications period for the new TLD process. Previously, we had said that it should be at least 4 months and shouldn't start until the final RFP is out. What the motion did is it recommended that the communications period start at the when the second RFP is posted, that it still lasts at least 3 months, but not end until at least 30 days after the final RFP is posted. The purpose for that basically was Principle A in the GNSO recommendation says that new generic top-level domains must be introduced in an orderly, timely, and predictable way, and this was to deal with the timely issue. And there had been, a lot of people complaining about this, and I understand that some people would rather it be delayed. I'm fully aware of that. So that's that motion. The second motion was, I believe, consistent with GNSO statements that have been submitted with regard to the CCNSO processes, in particular the IDNC work and the fast-track IDNC CTLDs, and it basically says that neither IDN CCTLDs nor IDN GTLDs should go in the route before the other unless both SOs agree. It went on to say that IDN CCTLDs should not be entered into the route until there is an enforceable commitment on the part of the operators to abide by security and stability requirements, IDN guidelines, the IDNA protocol, and that the IDN fast track would not be subsidized by other ICANN activities. In other words, they would be self-funding. Any questions?
I'd just like to note that in addition to forwarding the answers, these have been forwarded on to the board for whatever consideration they might like to provide to them. I'll take a cue if anyone has a cue. Does the staff have any issue or questions on these? Or are they self-explanatory and understood? Any comments to make? Anyone? In which case, if not, I'll pass on to the next issue. Okay, thank you, Chuck. And thank you, everyone. Glad those are clear. I just wanted to make sure of that. Okay, the next thing, and we've already gotten a lot of this from Kurt as part of the discussion. But basically, I had asked, and I specifically asked Olaf and Kurt on basically sort of a staff overview on comments received, and I'm certainly not asking them to repeat anything they said already, in keeping with my guidelines for this meeting of not repeating stuff. I don't know if there's anything that you would like to add to the discussion of the staff overview, or whether there, and if not, whether there are any questions about that from the participants on the call. So, Olaf or Kurt, do you have anything, or anyone else in the staff have anything you wish to add to that? No?
Well, Olaf here, and I see some particular part of that wood, but I think the overview is probably better in Kurt's hands. So if you need to, well, a global overview of the comments received or whatever, I rather suggest that Kurt respond to that.
Okay, thank you. Kurt, you've got the box.
Well, the information that's been posted so far, you know, just alludes to the breadth of comments and some of the key issues that have been raised in during the comment period. We've sorted through the issues, and and categorized them. So the communication that we're going to develop next, and I described it at the outset of the call, will essentially be to group the comments by issue, and then repeat what we think the issue is raised by a certain set of comments, and then provide a set of analysis that demonstrates first that we've heard the comment and that we're listening, and then we'll describe past consultations where and discussions where the issue was considered and how the present version of the guidebook came about, and then an analysis that's a balancing of the suggestion and the public comment to determine that. So the object is not only to print a or deliver a red line of the guidebook, but provide the annotation that describes why the annotation was made and the thinking that went into it. So to a real extent, the document is just as important or more important than the guidebook itself, because it seeks to demonstrate that the comment was taken into account, listened to, and this is how the link between the comment and a change to the guidebook was made. And because we want to attempt to communicate that the changes in the guidebook are certainly linked back to the comments we received. So we've...
Can I ask a question? Is that categorization and such coming out before the next guidebook, or is this all a package at the time of the next guidebook?
So if you think about it, we really can't do the amendment to the guidebook until the analysis is done. But the other side of that is, as analyses are done, and in certain cases they're done, amendments to the guidebook are made. So the guidebook will be done after the analysis is done. But how, given the practicality of, creating and posting a document, they probably won't be too far apart in time.
Okay, but there will be two separate events.
There'll be two separate documents, and I don't know how far apart they'll be.
Okay, thank you. Olaf, were you going to add anything in terms of any specific details on the comments?
Well, I can go through if
that'd be good.
Yeah, so just hang on one second while I get that out.
And while Kurt is getting it out, of course, there are different kinds of comments, some of which are pinpointing particular modifications that should be done in the process that we have seen. But, of course, there are other comments, as you well know, on a higher level that are on a more fundamental level, if you like, and a more global level. So that's one categorization which is pretty obvious. And those which address details in the implementation, that I'm swimming around for the time being, especially when it comes to the contention set handling and comparative evaluation, where there are very many and very useful comments indeed. So I think there's a split in the perhaps in the handling of these as well as from a staff perspective.
Okay. Look it up.
So just why I'm reticent to launch into this in the last 10 minutes of the call is that I'm going to cover some issues, but omit others, and certainly that's not what we're doing. We have, I'm looking at a fairly straightforward list of issues right here that have sub issues, and that we have a spreadsheet of all 300 comments that are sortable by issue and sub issue that it would take some time to review. So there's a few overarching issues that may not go directly to the applicant guidebook, but rather are important considerations for how the timing and how we go forward. So there was a lot of comment about how the effect of new GTLDs on the marketplace, just from an economic standpoint, and how it would impact the marketplace. There was also comment about the DNS stability effects, and I think the most important analysis suggested in that regard was that we've looked at how many TLDs the root zone can accommodate and certain other stability implications. We haven't looked at completely the combined effects of, say, introducing new GTLDs, IDNs, and DNSSEC essentially at the same time into the root zone. So, well, I think the outcome of that would be to indicate that it can be done in a way that ensures stability of the DNS. We're going to work further on that. Another overarching issue, I think, are branding and trademark issues, where brand name owners and their advocates said that additional mechanisms should be put in place to afford protections to brand holders, and also to make a determination if there was, how the process would increase cost to those brand holders and take that into account. So that is a question that needs to be answered fully before we go forward. And there are several issues that went to, changing the guidebook or the base agreement. There's a comment about registry. There's comments about registry, registrar separation, and the final model for that, which ICANN is developing. We recently published the public comment compilation on that, and we're going to publish a set of models that were proposed in consultations that were held, with the idea of arriving at aspects of them that would give us one model for going forward. So we're going to publish that in advance of this big document. There are other aspects of the registry agreement that were in public comment. The process for amending the agreement comes to mind. The omission of certain terms that were in previous registry agreements come to mind. So that's an important set of comments. Registry fees, both the application fee and the registry fee, but the public comment on registry fees was more pronounced, I think, the annual registry fee than the evaluation fees themselves. There were some comments about string similarity and how that was run, and also about and
whether the use of the algorithm and whether that should be modified and whether the panel criteria should be made more clear. We've talked about these in string contention. There were comments made about the scoring mechanism in comparative evaluation. Some thought the scoring mechanism was too strict. I think one thought it was one thought it was too tight. And no, I'm sorry. The majority of comments thought the scoring was too. I've lost track of what I was saying, so I'm going to start that sentence again. I'm sorry. So one set of applicants thought, or one set of commenters thought that the criteria for measuring community-based applications and comparative evaluations was too strict. One, I think, thought it was too lax, and probably nobody thought it was just right. The comments about the objection-based process really went to, I think, fleshing out more detail in the process and wanting to learn more detail, and not so much critical comment about what was posted to date. And there was comment about geographic names, both from on both sides of that issue, whether there should be a heightened reservation of geographic names and those that accommodating it just through the geographic, just through the objection process, and not having those applicants furnish some demonstration of community support with their applications. So, it's kind of a choice between taking 5 minutes to provide an overview of all the comments or a couple hours. So, that was a way too terse overview, but I'll say that the other thing I'm looking at here is a spreadsheet that I just removed from my desktop, but a spreadsheet that's hundreds of lines long that has all the comments and categories by module, category, and subcategory, and whether it's a question, a suggestion, or a comment, who made it, how what form they made it, and then we're beginning to flesh out. So, how do we analyze it, and what do we do with it? So, in some cases, that analysis is straightforward, or it's a simple comment that can improve the clarity of the guidebook. And in other cases, significant analysis is ongoing. Outside consultants are hired, and the like.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open up the queue for any few questions that people may have. We're almost out of time, but just in case anybody had a quick question. Okay, I'm hearing no quick questions. Thank Kurt for all of that. The last thing.
Actually, Aubrey?
Oh, yes.
It's Christina.
Okay.
Kurt, if I understood you correctly, just given the timing and the process of going through the comments and working on a new draft, the staff still think it's likely that the second draft will come out of before the Mexico City meeting?
Well, I think a second draft was a commitment that was made. Whether that fully answers all the issues or, part of the draft or part of the associated documentation says in these issues, analysis is ongoing for the next version of the guidebook. And that analysis won't wait for the next version of the guidebook. It'll be ongoing in a very public way. So, I think the answer is kind of yes. The answer is yes and no, right? Yes, there's going to be another iteration of the guidebook.
Do you anticipate then that there'll be a third draft?
Well, the plan has been to then publish a final version of the guidebook. There's been no decision made to deviate from that at this point.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? So, we've got 3 minutes left to discuss the follow-on process to this meeting, which we're obviously not going to get further. We're going to get done now, so I'm suggesting we take that to the list. And really the question that needs to be explored is, do we feel that this dialogue with the council and such, feel that this dialogue was sufficient to make sure that the issues where there was possibly variance and possibly not variance are on the table, are being looked at, and that it's sufficient to take the next draft, or do we feel we need to do something quickly and before that? And I don't know if anybody has a quick comment on that in the last 2 minutes. That's definitely a discussion that we'll have to continue on this. Anyone wish to comment on that quickly now? Okay, hearing no comment, as I say, I'll repeat the question on the GNSO list so that, you know, people can answer it and discuss it there, and then we'll cover it. Obviously, we need a drafting team if we are going to write anything, but the fact that we haven't done so up to now should be some sort of indicator. And if there's nothing else, at this point, I'd like to thank everyone for attending, everyone for the manner of attendance. I'd really like to thank Kurt and the rest of the staff for all they're doing and the constantly coming and being open to talk to us about this. And we'll be back at you again for sure, one way or another. And thank you all for putting up with me.
Hey, thanks, Aubrey.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, bye.
Thanks, bye.